Traveling the world, searching for equestrians of all breeds. The journey starts now on the International Equine Network.
Welcome to Flying Turns. This is Scott Miller with International Equine Report. We're going to go talk with Steve Wolf today. He is the host of Flying Turns on IEN. And Steve just got back from Paris, France. Steve, what were you doing in Paris?
I'll tell you, it's one of the best working vacations I've had in my life. And I was able, for Harness Link, to bring a team of gals and guys over there to give great coverage worldwide of the prestigious Prix de Mérique race just outside of Paris at the Paris-Vincennes Hippodrome. And don't ask me about any French, because I still don't know it any better.
There you go. I know it's tough. See, one thing I wanted to find out, you know, we know about the Kentucky Derby and the Breeders' Cup here in the country, but how did Paris prepare for this prestigious race?
Well, they work on it, apparently, from what I saw. They have to be working on it starting today for next year, because everything they did was timed out, was precision. Mother Nature cooperated. It was almost 50 degrees, but overcast most of the day. But everything went off like clockwork. And it was just amazing, everything that they did that day. I would love to be part of the planning for all of this, because it had to be really, really intense. I mean, there were parades and introduction of drivers, and they bring horses. And you know what they do? I mean, when we win a race, of course we go into the winner's circle, everything is done, but it's sort of kept away from the public. Where here, they bring the horse on the track apron, which was jammed with people. I mean, trying to get them to all back up and everything. And then once the couple pictures are taken, they get surrounded. And in the stands, there's sections with hundreds of people rooting for Sweden, rooting for France, rooting for Bald Eagle, rooting for Propulsion, rooting for FaceTime Bourbon, who won the race. And as we talked about earlier, Scott, I tried to go on the track apron up in the terrace where the media room was. I tried to walk down during the, you know, before the big race, just to get a feeling of the crowd. I couldn't get down the stairs. It took me 10 minutes to go 20 feet, elbow to elbow. And I said, I can't do this. And I ended up coming back up into the media room. And, you know, sadly, I had to watch a lot of it on TV, but I think it's great for the sport, and I would definitely acclaim the Prix de Mérique Day in Paris as the harness racing equivalent of the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, I agree with you. I watched it on LaTrot TV live and IENTV.org live, and let me tell you, Steve, it was amazing. And the thing that, you know, I was really puzzled by, it looked like the Indianapolis 500 finish line. There were so many people there, you know, and also now that you've been there, did you get any free time to go out to any of the training facilities or over to the
trotting museum? Yes. There's about a few hours drive away, there's a number of training facilities. And what people don't realize is that, yes, France is a country. And in that country, there's as many as 200 tracks, and they're all synchronized. They all belong to what is called the PMU, or the Paramutual Union in France. It's an actual union, so everybody has to abide by it. All the tracks have their schedule. They have the days of their races. If you go to most any bar or speakeasy in France, where you you can make bets or play the lottery, you're going to be able to wager on the races. And that's throughout the entire country. Plus the simulcasting. People don't realize, you know, you look at the medal. Go ahead, Scott.
What I was going to say is if they have that type of facilities there, is it a huge industry like it is here in the U.S.? Or, you know,
yes.
Is it? Oh, wow.
I would say it is bigger. The only thing bigger than the harness racing in France would be Would be soccer, or they call it football. I mean, that's the only sport that's bigger. Of course, the Olympics, but that's only every 2 years. But for horse racing on an annual basis, it's second only to soccer, which we know in throughout Europe, soccer is king. But in France, harness racing is I would have to say, probably bigger because of the track at Vincennes, bigger than the thoroughbred racing. Because I know on Derby Day they do over $100 million in wagering. It's the most that's ever bet any year on anything more than, they bet it all on the Derby. But, the Hamiltonian can draw 15,000 people and they can wager $4 or $5 million. But on this day, the Prix de Mérique Day, the 45,000 people plus everyone else in the world bet close to $40 million on the race card.
Wow. Well, you know, Steve, you know, this is such a big race, you know, and it's really now becoming, you know, a popular venue, you know, to go to. I understand that we had some people from Sunshine Meadows and the States over there.
Tony Alanya and a whole crew, Yannick Gingra, Dexter Dunn, Anthony McCarthy, Julie and Andy Miller, Nick Surik, Nancy Tactor, Chris Ryder. Yes.
And Steve Wolf.
and my team, Heather Vitale, who did the live social media. She was superb and had interviews with everybody you could imagine. I mean, I think on Prix de Mérique Day, I think she did like 15 live feeds just to cover everything. She didn't even, you know, it was so deafening loud that she couldn't do anything for the Prix de Mérique race because it was just so overwhelming.
Well, Steve, how about if you enlighten our listeners on just exactly what this race is and how it came about? I think they'll find that amazing.
Sure.
Such a huge race, you know, is dedicated to who?
To America. And it happened, the first Prix de Mérique, which by chance we picked the right time to go because it was the 100th anniversary of the race. The race was first held in 1920, and it was done as a tribute to the American soldiers who came over and fought in World War I. They were stationed in Paris. They helped liberate it from the Germans. The training center we're going to talk about soon, Gouvois, that was actually the castle that's there, was a hospital for American soldiers. The French were so thankful that they made their most prestigious race and they named it after the United States. And throughout the track, at every concession stand, every betting window, there were streamers, red, white, and blue, American flags posted. When you came to the track on Prix de Mérique Day, you were offered one of four different flags. You could get an American flag, a French flag, a Prix de Mérique 100th anniversary flag, or a Hippodrome Paris Vincennes flag, which I think was great because kids all had them. People had them waving them left and right. It was really a beautiful. And then they do a tribute parade. And in this parade this year were 100 Harley-Davidson motorcycles, 100 cheerleaders, men and women, dressed in red, white, and blue. 100 young, when I say young, I mean 8, 9, 10-year-old boys and girls dressed in all the different colors of the drivers. And they had 18 of those kids brought, you know, held hands with each of the 18 drivers, and they went walking right through the crowd to be introduced. And this is an hour and a half before the race is going to go off. And they had a huge birthday cake that exploded in a fireworks display. They had these actor horse people that were dressed in a horse outfit that was huge. You couldn't even see the people, but they moved around and did a dance. And then when that was all done, they had the French, I guess their cavalry, their Royal Lancers. And these are the men dressed up, and they had their own special Lancer band. This is the elite cavalry of the French army, I would say. They came out and did a whole performance with lancers and sabers in the infield. It was just amazing. And you didn't miss a beat, because at Vincennes, they have a huge jumbotron, just like Churchill Downs in the middle. And then they have two more, one at the top of the stretch, one at the end of the stretch, so that no matter where you're sitting, you can see the action that's going on, because the racetrack in Vincennes is like none other in the world. In Europe, they almost never race at a distance of a mile. They're always going more than that. They're going a mile and a quarter. They go a mile and a half. They go a mile and three quarters. The Prix de Mourique race itself is 1.67 miles. And the way the course is laid out, when you go into the first turn, you actually go, when you come off the first turn, you go downhill. And then you come uphill again, and then you race down the backstretch and around the final turn, you know, to equal the more than a mile and a half. And let go ahead.
You know, one thing that I noticed there is that from the grandstands, there's some parts of the track you can't see because they're down in the hills and in the valleys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when they're all the way, when they come out of the hill in the back, they're like almost half a mile away. But the camera system that they have at Vincennes is remarkable. They have two vehicles following the entire race, and they have a judge inside one of them. The other ones are cameras, so they're capturing every angle. And then the entire length of the stretch, just like in the NFL football games, they have a camera up on the high wire. So they're capturing all of that from above. I mean, the camera angles. And because I couldn't even get on the apron to watch a race, you know, I stayed in the media room. But in the media room, they had two, 150-inch TV monitors that, you know, we could watch everything on. And plus, they even had a replay machine. So as soon as any race was declared official, you could go up to the machine, hit the button, play that race, watch it again, because you have to. There's 14 to 18 horses in each race. There's cavalry charges from the beginning, halfway through the mile. They're three and four wide. And then the final turn, and they start, you know, rushing at them. And, you know, they say the stretch isn't as long as on a mile track, but yet it's still long enough that a horse in 12th place can make a challenge for the win.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing, the finish that they had there. You know, I was surprised that, you know, that they had that many fan across the track that wide. And, you know, the ones that were behind, it was just amazing to me, you know, to see that many sulkies and our bikes, you know, coming up. And it was a heck of a stretch drive there for the horse, you know.
Yeah, the horse, in other words, the driver that won the Prix de Mourique, his name is Bjorn Goop, and his father, Ollie, is a world-class driver who's since, I think he only drives a few times a year because he's up in age, but his son has taken over and has actually surpassed his father's records. And he knew, whether it was luck or not, he knew that he needed to follow a strong horse. And the horse that came first over his name was Davidson DuPont. He was one of the early favorites. And that horse was parked for his life. But he just kept on going and kept on going. And there's Ali Goop following him with FaceTime Bourbon. And then, you know, Ali or Beyond Goop had said earlier in the week in a story I had done for Harness Link, he said that, you know, you can follow, if you follow the right pack, you can win the race as long as you have a little luck. You got to have a little luck. And his luck was that the horse on the rail, because technically he was boxed in on the turn for home, and the horse on the lead, Excellence, he made a break. And as soon as he made a break, the driver took him right into the infield because they've got that room to get him out of the way so he didn't interfere with anybody. And that allowed Beyond Goop to drop from second over down along the rail. And then when his horse saw daylight, he took off and beat Davidson DuPont by a length and a half, who I have to give all the credit to. That horse was parked for his life. He had world-class trotters, propulsion, and then going at him. And he finished second. And then the very good mare, who's a super closer, Belina Jocelyn, she was able to finish third. But it was just a smart, smart drive. And by luck, that horse broke and gave him an opening. Otherwise, I think Davidson DuPont, they might have ended in the dead heat. Who knows what would have happened.
Yeah. How was the track condition? Was there were they close to a track record or, you know, any lifetime?
No, I looked at that. Earlier in the day, there was one race, I think one of the grade two races for 100,000 euros. I mean, they were racing for $1 million American in the big race.
Right.
But in one of the sub-races, a horse had taken a lifetime mark, which I thought was pretty good because we had really intense fog that morning, probably the worst that I've seen. And I saw them already on Saturday, you know, stripping the track, or I should say Friday, stripping the track and getting it all prepared. And Saturday, I saw a couple lifetime marks taken. But on Sunday, I think the track was just a little heavy wetness from the fog. I mean, were they, you know, 3 seconds off the mark? No, he was only a second off the stakes record. But, you know, it was a super day of racing.
Well, Steve, on our program, Client Turns, we're having a lot of fun, a lot of success with it. And about this time next week on our show, we're going to start introducing some of our sponsors and people that will make this happen, you know, for us. And eventually, you know, we'll go to video and radio, you know, on it. So,
that's what
we'll do. You know, every the 15 and the 30 and the 15. You know, we'll have 3 segments where we, you know, thank our sponsors and you know, go that route with it, you know, because it's what we're trying to do. You know, we're going to have a equestrian of the week, and we'll have a farm of the week, you know, that we'll introduce somewhere along in the show. So stay tuned for that. But the thing that I'm most interested in, with me being here at Sunshine Meadows and it being a premier, if not the best, training center for trotters and pacers in the country. How was your trip out to the training facilities that you went to?
Well, I only went to one training facility because it is probably the biggest training facility for harness racing in the world. And the name of it is, and I know I mess up the French and everything, but the name is Grobat. And the Grobat Training Center is actually its own little town because it is 1,000 acres for just this training facility. And it actually was deeded land from Prince Philip II in the 1500s, this property. And on it sits a castle. And I would say this castle is maybe 45,000 square feet of living space, surrounded by a moat. Now, the moat is dry, and they actually have beautiful manicured lawns in the bottom of the moat now, and they have peacocks living there, which is cute. But you can actually see the walls that were first constructed in the 1600s to build this place. And this paramutual union, when it first got started, they told the government they needed to have a place that they could train the horses to race at Vincennes, and they were able to buy Grosbois and turn it into a, you know, this unreal facility. I know I talked about it earlier, but now I got to actually see it and be there. There's 5 miles of jogging tracks. There's a half mile strip that's like a big, heavier, you know, material, deeper to work the horses. There's 3 different surfaces that you can jog on. They have a 60-man crew that takes care of all these tracks and the buildings and stalls. And unlike a shed row barn that would have 40 horses, you have, I call them courtyards. It is. It's an actual courtyard, a full square that has 40 stalls in it. But it's attached to an office that's attached to a 4-bedroom house. And one of the trainers that we were friendly with, his name is Anders Lindquist, a top trainer in his day. He let us come there and see everything, and he took us around. And the place, his courtyard, it's just impeccable. It's beautiful. It's such a great surrounding. And he only has 3 horses. He rents out the other, you know, 37 stalls to other trainers to come in. But I know he said it cost him about $8,000 a month to have that 40 stalls and courtyard. So he said as long as everybody pays him, you know, he can stay there, and he has, you know, for 25 years. So he's done okay with it. But still, these trails go through the woods, and it's a sanctuary. It's like a protected, you know, a home. It's a part of the French history.
Right.
So
right.
Nobody can go hunting on it. And as we came by on one jogging trail, he said, look, you see how the ground's all dug up and everything right up to the track? It says those are the wild boars digging for truffles,
man.
Which I thought was interesting. And they have reindeer and foxes and hawks and all sorts of, you know, wildlife. Ringneck pheasant, we saw them flying around. And apparently when you're jogging early in the morning, you can see the reindeer as they're just getting up, you know, sleeping in the woods and stuff. And it's just magnificent. It's beautiful. Now, but on top of the 5 miles of jogging track, they also have 2 racetracks because horses qualify there to race at Vincennes. Vincennes is only, and it's only about 7 miles away, but the racetrack at Vincennes is only used for racing and special events. There's no training there. You can do it all at Grosbois. I mean,
Wow. There's
a 5/8 mile stone dust track, and then there's a 15/16 of a mile track. And depending on which one they're going to use that day that they have that's in better shape, that's the one you would qualify on.
Well,
go ahead.
I heard you had a good rating over there. You're talking about all the tracks and how big it is. There was a damsel in distress. She lost her way from the barn and was lost.
Oh, there was a woman from Sweden who said when she first got there, it was so magnificent. And one day was a beautiful spring day, and she took her horse out for a jog, for a 5-mile jog, and she went on a trail, and then she took a different one, and then when she tried to go back, she got lost. And finally, after a couple more miles of jogging, she came across a French trainer who had a horse out, and he couldn't speak any English or Swedish. So she couldn't explain to him that she was lost. How do I get back? So she ended up, I think, just following him. And I think that poor horse, instead of going out for a 5-mile jog, went 15 miles. And she said it didn't happen to her once. It happened to her twice until she finally learned where to go. Because apparently when you cut through the woods, they have trails, you know, that you can go to the left, go to the right. It can take you right back to where you were again, you know, depending on which way you want to go. I guess But and if you were to take breadcrumbs and leave a trail, the squirrels and birds will eat it all before you can find your way home.
Oh man!
But there's more, Scott. There's all these different courtyards and buildings, and some of them have built the automatic walkers right inside their courtyard.
Wow!
So, but they always have enough room, of course, to take a horse and go. Then we went to another facility. It was two different barns, buildings in the center. And lo and behold, it's an equine hospital with two surgical rooms. And apparently they have 15 veterinarians there. And certain places have blacksmith shops, or blacksmiths can come with their own vehicle and bring their own equipment to do everything, and they just drive right into the courtyard. But apparently they have 25 to 30 blacksmiths that, you know, people can use any blacksmith they want, but those are the regular ones there. Because you got to figure, if there's 1,200 horses, not even when it's filled, like right now, when we were there, it was filled. I mean, 1,500 horses. It takes takes the vets quite a while to get around to everybody, and the same with the blacksmith. But I think the best compliment for this place, and I'm not done talking about it yet, but the best compliment I heard when I was in France actually came from John Campbell. And he told me that if you bring a horse to Grosbois and you cannot make that horse improve on himself after training him there, then the horse is not going to ever improve.
Oh, man.
Because he said this. Yeah, he said, you know what? Whatever your horse's problem is, they have a track for going on it. Probably the only thing I didn't see there, which I thought would have been useful, was an indoor swimming pool for the horses. But they say if they want to, they can take them nearby and they can swim. They swim them in lakes.
Right, right. Well, you know, I heard that they're going to ask you back again because it's the first time they had sun in a long time. In good weather.
Oh, the weather.
Yeah.
You know what? I got there on Tuesday morning and left on Monday. And the only time it ever rained was when we were leaving on Monday, a week later. And I had a few people tell me it had to be you because they've never been to France that week and had 6 days of no rain.
Yeah. Well, you know,
it was cold, though.
Yeah. Oh, it was? Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
this southern boy was cold.
Yeah. Talking about the rain and everything, over at the training facility, when it rains, what do they do with the horses?
Oh, that's right. Thank you for that lead-in. like I said, there's more to talk about. And Anders Wingquist, he takes us to this huge, round, almost dome-type building. And when they open up the door, there's a woman and a man. They each have horses, and they're lunge lining them in the indoor arena. But this is an indoor arena you could probably hold a rodeo in. That's how big it was. And apparently that is used extensively because in France they have only trotters. But they also have what they call Monty, which is racing under saddle. And you have to, of course, maintain the trot. Rules are all the same as in regular racing, but you're riding the horses. So they have so many of the horses there are just, you know, for the Monty. Some of them can be hooked up to a sulky and race that way. But the majority of the different horses there that, you know, they breed them. They breed them for just like a thoroughbred. They breed them for, you know, high-stepping, long-stepping trotters that they ride under saddle. And the week before we got there, they had the championship for Monty, and I think they had 14 horses race for 650,000 euros, which is like 700,000 American racing. So you see a lot of people out there riding a horse next to someone who's jogging because they're still got to work the horse one way or the other, where you ride them or you jog them, and they like to break the horses to saddle so that by riding them, you're exercising different muscles than you are in the horse pulling a jog cart. And they go for total fitness. You see, they're not into speed. They're into stamina. fine. If the horse breaks a record or something, you know, it went fast enough, that's fine. But their main thing is that they won the race. That's what they care. Time is irrelevant as long as you win.
Right. They don't give you any more money for winning a fast time or a slow time. It's all the same
no,
amount.
No, no. But they used to, Scott. In the old days, I can remember at Brandywine Raceway, they would have like $2,500 prize, cash prize to the owner of the horse that could break the track record on the trotter pace.
Yeah,
you know, but that's but then again, like I said, the French really don't worry about that. They worry that their horse has stamina, that if their horse has to get parked first over, which is going to happen, that it can stay there all the way to the finish.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And I also, one of the most important things that I saw there that I want to say something about is, and they're doing it in Ireland and they're doing it in Europe, they do it in Sweden, is they have programs for the young kids to drive ponies or miniature horses, and they have all the same equipment, and they must keep them on a trot. And I saw the kids race a half a mile with ponies on the trot, and it was cute. It was adorable. An 8-year-old boy had won the race, and actually there were three different horses, and they kept changing the lead. You could just see the kids. A horse would start to, pony would start to almost gallop, and you could see them pull back on the lines and just ease them back on the trot. And but that's what the harness racing sport needs to revitalize, is to get young people like they're doing over there. Plus, France has an extensive, it's almost college program for the horse industry. They have a full program if you want to be a caretaker or a bug rider,
right,
for the under saddle. They teach you all that. And if you want to, they have that's a 2-year program, hands-on. And then when you graduate, you are licensed groom or exercise rider. And then you can go right up and try learn and get your trainer's license or your jockey license. Go ahead.
You know, I've heard of that program, and I've actually dealt with some people in Ocala that came from France. They were trainers and riders and so forth. And they stayed here about 3 years, and then they went back to their country. And they said it was amazing, you know, the schooling that they could get there, you know, that type of thing. And then, they had great success here.
They have so many smaller tracks that race. Only Vincennes in Paris is probably the only track that races, 5-6 days a week. The other tracks race, you know, a couple days a week, and you know, every track that races, they're going to show their races. You know, they put them in between. In other words, here you might have four tracks going against each other. There you could have 7 tracks in one day, but yet they all fit in their feature races, give them prominence so that everyone in France will be betting on them, and that track can gather, you know, that much more money. But what I wanted to say, Scott, let me finish.
Okay.
The school, they also have a 3-year program that teaches you racetrack management so that when you graduate from that class, you can go to one of these tracks throughout France and get a job, you know, and get hired. I mean, it's a great, great program. I read all about it at the Trotting Horse Museum, which happens to be in the Guabois Castle that's right in the middle of this whole facility.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, it seems like that it's like part of their culture, you know, that you have a certain segment of the life that it's really, all about the equine and, you know, that the country gets behind them. Now, that museum has to be, you know, some kind of, facility.
Right. It's only 10 years old. I mean, our Trotting Museum in Goshen, New York, which is unbelievable. It's just magnificent. But it's also been built and worked on for 50, 60 years. So it's really tops and all of racing. But what they have there, the location, just like Goshen, it's just beautiful. And as you drive, when you jog a horse or drive in or anything, wherever you go, that's in the center. So you can actually use that to help you find your barn and go home. And they also have a huge horseman's cafeteria and a big party game room where they have karaoke nights and foosball and ping pong and all those, you know, different activities for the grooms and trainers and stuff. Because I'm sure, you know, it's the dead of winter and nobody wants to be hanging outside doing anything.
You're right. Hey, Steve, just to mention on one of the documentaries that we've been working on, it's called How They Get There, the 2020 Kentucky Derby. The sales are important to the thoroughbred horsemen, you know, to try to pick out a Derby winner or, you know, a Breeders' Cup winner. And it's my understanding that one of the best sales in all of France and all of Europe is the sales that they have during the
Breed Marie week.
Yeah, there you go.
You're right. It starts out that week on Thursday, the mixed sale. That's at night. And then on Friday, they have the sale continuing. The best horses are sold at around 7 o'clock at night. But from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., they have one of the biggest horse expos I've ever been to. I'm talking 200 displays of everything, harness racing, equine, for the farmers. They were able to bring small backhoes into the grandstand of the track to have on display. And the track apron was filled, 20, 30 horse trailers and horse lifts. You know, they're the smaller vehicle that can hold two horses and the bikes and everything, but it's attached right to the car so you can literally get up and go right into the back with the horses, the passenger can, while you're driving around. And they had all those on display, and horseshoes and harnesses. And I saw a machine called My Groom that I think I would love to have if I was back in the business. It's a portable, specialized washing machine that you just pick up, you wheel to the stall area, you plug it in, you add some of the solvent or soap stuff, you throw in a couple, not even a gallon of water, but then you can take the horse's harness and put it right in. You take the horse's bridle with the bit on. Don't touch anything. Throw it in with the harness. You know, grab some of your rags, dirty rags and stuff, throw it in there, turn it on, and 40 minutes later, you pull out, and that harness and bridle are impeccable. I mean,
amazing.
It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. And it's some powdered soap material that with a little bit of water cleans everything. Doesn't make a mess. You don't need to hook up a hose. When you're all done, you tip it out, and maybe half a gallon comes out of the machine, and that's it. You pull out your harness. It's back in like new. The rugs, the big rugs, the whole horse rugs that they use out there, they get muddy. The horses roll in puddles and do everything else. They just take it off the horse, throw it in the machine, throw in a little bit of soap and water, boom. That thing comes out 40 minutes later. They have even hangers they give you. You hang the stuff up, and in an hour, they're all dry and ready to go on the horse.
Yeah. Hey,
I thought that was neat.
Speaking of that wash machine, you know, they're very innovative on, you know, products and things. One of the people we're going to be dealing with down the road is Hallway Feeds. We're going to do an interview with them. They're out of Lexington, Kentucky, and they're an international company, and they feed horses all over the world. You know, did you see any tack shops or feed stores close to the venue there, or
no, what they have, what I saw was a FinTac warehouse store on the grounds at the training center at Grabeau. I mean, it wasn't just a tack shop that you'd go into. This was a warehouse.
Yeah.
Primarily because you have 1,200 to 1,500 horses there, so of course they need all that equipment and stuff, but you have other trainers that are driving, you know, a couple hours from training facilities, and when they get there, they're going to want to get stuff to take home. So they've got, you know, FinTac has the big outfit there, but they had all different, you know, some different feed companies there. They also had material companies there, depending, you know, I didn't see any shavings. Everything is done with straw.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if right. you wanted shavings, you can buy them, but, you know, there's a whole thing with disposable of the dirty, you know, exactly. manure-ridden shavings to get rid of them. But you can get them, and they had them there with all different styles. You could pick what tree you want your horse's bedding to be on. and they also had track material, you know, so that all different ones there that you could look and see, you know, to decide what you wanted to have for your farm. Yeah. I saw screens and harrows, the type I've never seen before. And I'm sorry. And, Case International was one of the lead sponsors of the Prix de Mérique. So, of course, on the racetrack, pulling these harrows and screens and stuff are these brand new, you know, $150,000 Case tractors.
Yeah.
That was very impressive. I mean,
one of the things that I find amazing, and I'm just fascinated, when I was there, you know, for the thoroughbred business, I got to meet the people at PMU and go to, you know, several thoroughbred tracks and all. But I was amazed how organized everything seems to be, you know, in the industry there. You know, it's like a culture. They live the life, and, you know, the life they live is the horse. And one thing I wanted to ask you, did you see a wide range of ages, from older people down to young children, or was it 20 to 35?
You know what? It was a mixture of everything. Depending where I was at Grosbois, the training facility, I saw young people sitting in the sulky, you know, with a parent or someone else going jogging around. I saw a lot of young people from different countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland, along with the French. I saw the older, seasoned trainer drivers who were, you know, still like an Anders Lindqvist. I mean, these guys, they never retire. They just go on and on, working the horses. I mean, but at the racetrack, I saw everybody. There were plenty of young kids. I mean, I don't know, you know, how good they were, because there wasn't like they could run around waving a flag or something, because it was just so crowded.
Right.
But there are. It is much, much more young people and things at the track. And granted, I wasn't there during the week, or like this week when there isn't any fanfare to see, you know, how many people and stuff. But my wife was fortunate to sit with the Breeders' Crown table up high, having dinner, and she took fabulous pictures and saw everything, said the food was unbelievable. And but the one thing we forgot to talk about, between the Horse Expo and the sale on Friday, there I saw more champagne being drunk than I did in my life. If there were 200 display units there, 150 of them had champagne, and they all were offering it to you. It was,
you know,
actually,
when I saw that on TV, I couldn't believe how big the Magnums were. They were huge. It looked like a Formula One race or a NASCAR race, and the bottles were huge, and they were spraying the crowd with it.
That,
you know,
those bottles, I think, are like $500 each, because it's not cheap champagne, even though they did spray it around and non-caring, but they had fun. But, jeez, I got there at 9:30 in the morning on Friday. By 9:45, I had my first glass of champagne. I was looking for some orange juice to make it legit mimosa, but they didn't have that. And then a gentleman, a Willem van Houtrozen from Belgium, a trainer, driver, breeder, who's got, you know, some good local stallions, but he also has the breeding rights to Father Patrick and a number, always be, or not always be Mickey. He has breeding rights from Propulsion, who was actually in the race, but he's got breeding rights. He told me in the easiest words that because in France, champagne is domestic, and thus everyone's producing it, and it is cheaper for a good bottle of champagne than a six-pack of Coke.
Oh, man. I'll be doggone. That's good. That is good.
Yeah, that was surprising.
You know, Steve, it sounded like you had a good time. We've been talking about it. Now let's get down. We're getting towards the end of our show. Let's get down to the race itself. FaceTime Burke. Oh, what a horse.
What a horse is right. You know what? He's only 5 years old, which in Europe, that's the prime age to start off a great career. Only FaceTime, and he's by he's sired by Reddy Cash, who had won the Prix de Marie twice, world champion for five straight years. He's thrown other great horses, and but this one was a late bloomer. He actually Sebastian Guerrero is the one that trains him. He didn't race at age two, and was lightly raced at age three and four, but he had 21 starts, lifetime starts, going into this Prix de Marie. Of those 21 starts, he won 18 times with 2 seconds. So I think once he finished fourth or fifth. So he was prime. I mean, he had won the qualifying race to get in. Everyone was talking about him, but they also thought that he was a little young to take on the best older trotters in the world. But let me tell you, he proved them wrong, that's for sure. I mean, like I said earlier, Bijan Gout gave him a superb drive and saved every inch of track for him. But still, the fact that he won and he beat all these great horses was amazing.
Yeah, now, I know Bijan had a choice of horses, didn't he?
Yes. There was the Jocelyn, not Jocelyn, I have to think, maybe. Yeah, the Davidson DuPont. I think he could have driven that horse. There are a couple he had, but obviously he knew that FaceTime Bourbon was in prime shape for it. I mean, I was a little disappointed because the Bold Eagle, who came over here, the world champion, he won the Prix de Marie twice. I think he was third last year. But he came over to the United States and won the Breeders' Crown, which was only a sprint a mile long, but he crushed the field by four legs, but he couldn't do anything. He couldn't muster. I think he finished 10th.
Right. Well, you know, I know that he Lauren had won the 2018 race with, what was his name?
Red Express.
Right. And then he came back with him again in 2019 and finished third. And, you know, I was just amazed. You know, he has, what, over 7,000 career wins now?
Yes, which in Europe is an awful lot. I mean, the leading driver in Europe, Heinz Weringer, is, he has 15,000 wins, but he's also in his early 70s. He still drives some.
Yeah,
but and at one point he was ahead of Hervé Filion, but then Dave Pallone came and blew them all by. Dave Pallone's got over 19,000. He'll probably hit his 20,000th win in the next year. But Bijan Gout, who's 35 years old with 7,000 wins, that's very, very impressive. And now after winning this race, he's going to be in such demand. He smiles all the time, and and another thing, Scott, everybody over there speaks three, sometimes four languages.
Yeah.
Because they learned French fast, then they had their native language. Right. Most of them speak some English because that's the universal language for harness racing is English.
Right,
so
right.
Everyone knows at least three languages, but
right.
some of the other people, you know, Anders Lindqvist, he's born from Sweden, so he speaks perfect
right.
Swedish. He speaks Belgium. He speaks French. He speaks an excellent English. He speaks Italian, Dutch. You know, it's
yeah.
just amazing over there that everyone speaks all these different languages. But it's, you know what? I was able to sit in his living room with four or five other horsemen. One gentleman was approaching 90, and all he pretty much does, he still lives there. He's got his pension from the French government. He has his reserve chair because we got up to let him have it. And we talked with him because he was around when all the races were finally being developed. And he had
yeah.
some great stories. And the other people, young people from other countries. I mean, it's just like, excuse the expression, shooting the shit with everybody at Sunshine Meadows.
Yeah.
Well, only instead of sitting out at the deck where in the beautiful sunshine, we're inside with a fireplace where it's nice and warm.
Yeah, there you go. Well, see, one of the other things I wanted to ask about, when I was there with the thoroughbreds, a lot of times some of the trainers and owners didn't race with shoes on. And, you know, it was kind of their call. They would train them with shoes on, and then on race day they would pull the shoes off. And
That's right.
I know that the standardbreds there in Europe, they do that quite often, don't they?
In fact, I was really surprised. 18 horses in the Prix de Mourique race, and not one of them wore shoes. They all raced barefoot. And if they do, when they jog them, they might put shoes on them just to protect their feet. And then, like you said, they pull the shoes off before they race, and then their feet just feel lighter, and they reach out more. You know, it's just a mind thing, but it works.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing how the different things that, you know, in the horse business works in one place and not, you know, not another. And, you know, like you were saying with the track, if you go there and train and your horse doesn't improve, you know, then, you know, you better get back to the sale and find you another horse.
Exactly. And for John Campbell, I mean, he also talked about his regrets in that he's come over three different times now. And the first time he came over, he had the opportunity that he could have drove in a few of the races. And he was really sad that he never did that because he thought it would have been great. But I think one of the greatest tributes that I saw on Friday, they had a race for the Hamiltonian Society, of which John Campbell is now president of. So it was himself and Tom Charters and the executive director, Moira Fanny, were all up on stage, and they were doing interviews, and then they were waiting for the winner of that race to come for the trophy presentation. Well, this trainer-driver, and his name escapes me right now, when he came up on the stage and to do the trophy thing, he went right over to Mr. Campbell and got on his hands and knees and raised his arms and bowed up into him. And everybody cheered and clapped. They thought John, of course, was totally embarrassed but you know, at least could laugh at it. But it just showed the kind of respect. And then afterwards, the people started lining up. They had pictures of Mack Lobel. They wanted John to autograph. He took pictures with them. I mean, it was just a great, great, you know, little side tribute to John Campbell. That this driver, you know, was in presence of a great, great guy.
That's better than any trophy you could get.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's better than any trophy that you could get. You know, I'm just amazed at the racing in Europe, and I'd like to see that, you know, grow here. I like your, you know, suggestion that you had about the little kids and, you know, learning, you know, with.
That's in order to keep our sport alive. And you see it outside at Sunshine Meadows.
Yeah.
When people drive here in the mornings, especially on like a Saturday, they're going to see how many kids all dressed up in a $500, $700 equestrian outfit to get up on their ponies or horses and do dressage and jump, learn how to jump and do that stuff. And all I can say is if there was a mini horse barn, let's say with six or seven mini horses with all the equipment, which is exactly like a harness, I think parents would say, hey, I want my kid to learn this. They can see eye to eye with the horse. They learn the finesse of keeping them trotting, even though they're not going that fast. But it's the exact same thing, and it would just help more people get educated and learn that there's so many careers you can have, you know, in the horse business.
Well, that, you know, that's what we're trying to do here at the International Equine Network, is expose the industry to all the things that, you know, that would you know, could help our industry by offering programs like that, you know, educating the people. You know, and so when we get into our other programming here, you know, we'll talk about the kids and the programs that they have to feed, you know, the industry, you know, that we need so desperately. You know,
absolutely.
The other thing
that I saw over there, much more than here in the United States, number one, because of the Monty, there's a lot more women jockeys. There's also more women drivers and trainers. Now, we have a lot of trainers, per se, but we only have a handful of women that drive, except when we have the non-wagering Monty races. And then all of a sudden, you see one male jockey in a race against five females.
Right.
And same in Europe.
You know, Julie Crone, I think it was Moneymaker, she set a world record on him, and she comes right out of the thoroughbred business, you know, up in New Jersey and rides Moneymaker, and, you know, it was amazing, you know.
Sure, and we've had top women drivers, the Looney family, Joanne, her daughter Susan, they were top drivers at the Meadowlands. But other than Jacqueline and Gracia and a handful of others, you don't see as many as you do in Europe. There's so many more.
Well, Steve, it's good to have you back, and you know, I'm glad you got to, you know, enlighten us on it, you know, and maybe you put the bug in somebody's ear to, you know, get involved in harness racing
I didn't like the cold there, and I'm not a fan of the French food. But if I had the opportunity to go back, I probably would, because there's things that I didn't get to do that I'd want to do again. That's how great it was. And I was offered to jog a horse at the Grabois training facility, but it was way too cold. I didn't want to have to. I'd rather go there if I could in the springtime or something, and then to be able to jog out there and see the place behind a horse would be superb.
Say from the French point of view. Hey, Steve, next week on our program, I'd like to talk a little bit about, like, the Breeders' Crown and, you know, start talking about the standardbred season coming up, you know.
We have to talk about the Mohawk Million.
Yeah, the Mohawk Million. Yeah, that's another thing. And, you know, we'll kind of go more in depth to, you know, on the deck here with Myron Bell, you know, and his group, how they're doing things. And, you know, we'll kind of map out a roadmap, you know, for our listeners so that they can follow, you know, and go to, you know, the Hambletonian, the Little Brown Jug, the Breeders' Crown, you know, that type of thing. You know, I believe the Breeders' Crown's in Indiana this year, and there's a lot to do there. At Hoosier Park, you know, and so we kind of get onto that and you know, all the other things. And kind of jump around Harness Link and see what news items are coming out. You know, just kind of go from there.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot we can always talk about. No shortage of good stuff going on.
Yeah. We'd like to thank all Steve for going over and doing what he did. Like to thank BBS Radio for giving us the opportunity and helping us with all the production facilities. What we're doing, IENTV.org is our website. We're rebuilding and reconstructing that this weekend. So there'll be a lot of things on there. And Steve, I look forward to talking with you and seeing you next week on Flying Terns.
Okay.